Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Routes, the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between food production and food consumption. Susan Bradford, I'm going to make a crystal ball. It's not really a crystal ball because we're not doing it. But if I were to say I was going to introduce somebody other than Susan Bradford today, I think my regular listeners would be in a revolt because they're suddenly becoming addicted to your research. How are you?
Oh, I'm glad. I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm glad the information is resonating. I think the truth resonates. So I'm glad that they're finding some value in what I'm having to say.
The truth does resonate. It's just so noisy. People are trying to figure out where to tune the ear to get the truth and sort from the noise.
Well, I'm doing my best to deliver you the truth for you and your audience.
So what's on tap for today?
Okay, so today I thought we could talk about immigration and how our country lost control of our borders and why this kind of system is becoming a broken immigration system is becoming kind of self-perpetuating.
So I had no idea what you had on your mind, but I went and did a little research on the agricultural and food sector post-World War I. And it was, we often hear about the Roaring Twenties. The Roaring Twenties were anything but roaring for agriculture. It was a mass exodus of farmers, and government tried to meddle into farming enterprises. And I'm telling you that because I also learned, and didn't really recall if I ever knew it, that we put massive regulation on any type of immigration into the United States during that period of time. Apparently, we got over that because we have no deterrent or resistance to illegal migration to this country today.
I think during the period of the Roaring Twenties, I think that our government knew that there was a very subversive element within Europe, and that you're talking about right before World War One, World War Two, that they knew that there was a subversive element within Russia, within Europe, that was trying to overtake our country, communists and so forth. And I think in the 1920s, thereabouts, you're looking at really the beginnings of the Federal Reserve. And I think at that time, our political establishment was very much opposed to what these international financiers were trying to do to their country.
Yes, because it was 1913 that they created the Federal Reserve.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they knew what was coming up and what was happening.
So how does that tie to today and what is taking place?
Okay. So at the end of World War II, the elites led by Rothschild had decided that they would elevate communist China to lead the new world order, and they would reduce the United States to a bankrupt welfare state. This was agreed by Joseph Stalin, Rothschild bloodline, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, also Rothschild bloodline, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, controlled by the bankers who answered to Rothschild. So this was an agenda that was agreed by all three men on behalf of their countries, and which was set into motion.
I want to interrupt you, Susan.
Go ahead.
Because I know exactly when this took place, because I have a picture on my computer that I look at once in a while because it just irritates me to no end. But it is Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, Franklin Delano Roosevelt sitting on a park bench just having a grand time because they just defeated Germany. And at the same time all of this is happening, we know that Stalin is killing people by the millions in Russia.
Millions. Yeah, he was doing it with the support of Wall Street, in particular J.P. Morgan. Like, they were bankrolling his efforts.
Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that picture just is a burr under my saddle.
No, that's a very good point. Our country has purported to be opposed to tyranny and communism, and to be fighting on behalf of freedom and democracy. But the truth is that Wall Street financed all of those revolutions and did indeed finance communism as a strategy to claim greater market share, to control governments, and to establish monopolies within those countries. Yes, they were willing to sacrifice lives to that end.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, I interrupted you. Carry
on. Okay, so moving right along. So during the might have, I guess, before the Nixon administration, there was a group that was formed called the National Committee of U.S.-China Relations. This was formed in part by Kissinger in the church house within the United Nations building. And the purpose, it was formed with Kissinger, and the purpose of this organization was to convince America to open its doors to communist China. So they were going to paint a really beautiful picture. Oh, there's nothing to be afraid of. This, you know, butcher who killed millions of his own people. That we should be open to the Chinese, and they brought the elite of the country, from academia, the media. From the fields of business and politics to this committee to sort of convince them that China was very benign, that there was a lot of money to be made, a lot of value to be had through cultural exchanges. And very gradually, they were able to kind of insinuate themselves into the establishment to create like a momentum and support behind communist China. So what resulted from this is that you have an elite that is now, you know, predisposed to supporting China. They were engaging in cultural exchanges, exchanges between the media, our network media, and China. We're going there to become indoctrinated into supporting communist China as, you know, a new leader, an emerging power. And among those who were educated or convinced to join and advance that agenda was a gentleman by the name of Senator Ted Kennedy. And I'm sure you know who he is. Ted Kennedy was the son of Joseph Kennedy, an ambassador to the UK during World War II. He was privy to the agenda. And he warned America about the agenda, but he also did something else. And that is that he married one of his daughters, Kick Kennedy, into the British aristocracy, which made her the family by default, an extended family of the Rothschilds. And the attitude of the Kennedys was that what is happening within Europe is very dangerous. It is not in our interest, but we can't beat them. We might as well join them. And Joseph Kennedy's view was that if I want my sons to become president, then we've got to go along with this agenda. So Ted Kennedy knew that the forces behind communist China, and again, we're talking about the Rothschilds and financial elites, and we can, on a different show, I can you know, discuss how we created communist China. But with these, in line with this agenda, Ted Kennedy began to reorganize our immigration policy. So before we had immigration that we had a quota system. We'd only take a certain number of people from each country. We tended to select individuals who were aligned with our cultural values, with our demographics, so they could more easily assimilate into the nation. But Kennedy transformed our immigration policy so that we would begin to recruit individuals who were from countries that were fomenting communist revolution. They were from countries whose values were diametrically opposed to ours. And this was in line with the communist agenda. And if you look at the Kissinger transcripts, you'll see Henry Kissinger and Mao Zedong, who was the communist Chinese leader, actually discussing how importing all different nationalities into the United States would invite trouble. And they wanted to invite trouble to collapse the United States, to kind of weaken it from within. So Kennedy established a lottery system. He began to weaken our controls. And among the ways that he was able to incentivize immigration, especially from poor countries, areas where the individuals could not support themselves and weren't coming here for freedom, but for a meal ticket, is that they established a cottage industry around immigration. So you'd have the federal government financing housing, Section 8 housing, welfare, every sort of benefit imaginable that would be provided by the government. The contractors would take a very substantial, generous take for themselves, becoming very rich in the process. And then they, in turn, would be incentivized to invite more immigrants into the country.
Susan Bradford, investigative journalist. We've already shot through the first segment. We're back with segment two. Roll out after this. Let's talk about beef, and in this case, we're talking about tender beef. Get more details about certified Piedmontese, 100% grown in the Great Plains of America by cattlemen you know. No imported beef in this deal, and it is the most tender beef on the planet. We know that because every single calf is tested to make sure and verify the tenderness gene is present. Now, what's a tenderness gene? It's just a gene that regulates or does not regulate muscle growth, and in this case, this one does not regulate muscle growth. There's two copies of this gene, the myostatin gene. It's pretty interesting if you want to go look at the science behind that. Beyond all of the science, here's how you reap the rewards. You don't have to worry about going to the store. We deliver the tender beef to your door, and then when you consume it, you say, man, that was some tender beef. It's all about the most nutritional nutrient substance on the planet, beef. Get more details and place your order today at cpbeef.com. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Lewis, alongside Susan Bradford joining us. She's an investigative journalist. And I'll have to say that I've never been a big fan of the Kennedys, although what's going on with Bobby today seems to be a little different. But with all that said, John F. Kennedy, and Bobby Kennedy Sr. seem to be completely different and march to a different beat of a drum than Ted Kennedy. There always seemed to be something different about Ted Kennedy.
Ted Kennedy was very closely aligned with the Clintons. Bill Clinton was reportedly a Rothschild bloodline as well. Some say he was the son of Winston Rockefeller, but he was according to royal historians, he was the biological son of Winston Churchill and Pamela Harriman, the wife of Averell Harriman, who established the national security state within the United States. So he was groomed from a young man, from a child, to become president. And the purpose of sending him over was to fulfill the Atlantic Charter. That's why he was sent over. But he was going to, realign the debt, or he was going to forgive the debt that the British owed the United States, you know, through his administration.
I'll have to check the year, but there's still a big tribute that Winston Churchill made a trip and gave an instrumental speech in Fulton, Missouri. I don't remember the exact year, but now Missouri is a neighboring town to Arkansas. So now I'm going to have to go back and do a little digging on when that trip was, when Clinton was born, and the whole ball of wax. But anyway, I just had to share that about Ted Kennedy because he just always seemed to beat to some different drum.
I think the Kennedys are aligned with the Zionists, but I think there's a tension there because the Kennedys are more closely aligned with the Vatican. And so within the Kennedy, within that conservative circle, you have the clashes between those who are more inclined towards Judaism and aligned with the Rothschilds and those who would align with the Vatican, with Catholicism. So I think they want one or the other to preside over the New World Order.
Wasn't it November 26, 1963, that definitely the world changed forever?
Which date was that?
November 26, 1963, I'm sure is the day that JFK was assassinated.
Yes, that's true. There are a few reasons why that might have happened. After World War II, the elites established they acquired the nation's gold, which they had stolen, and they had set up I believe they're called collateral accounts that were going to be used. These were kind of accounts and like a fund that was backed by gold that they were going to use to finance the development and improvement of the world. And Kennedy knew that they were instead stealing the gold, and he was trying to kind of restore control of those assets to the proper owners. To stop the theft in progress. And I don't know if he was doing this to fulfill his own personal ambitions, or if he was doing it on behalf of the Vatican, or if he truly had, you know, noble intentions. But he was the son of Joseph Kennedy. He was also very closely aligned with the mob. So he was not a saint by any means, though I think that he was among those who did buck the system. And anybody who bucks the system at that high of a level has bad things happen to them. And you can see that happening routinely among the Russian oligarchs and among any other and among the elites, that if they get out of line, that they might not live, to tell about what transpired.
Yeah, I don't think anybody can question in today's world that JFK was executed because he was close to uncovering something. And what
Something.
you said makes as much sense as anything, but he clearly was bucking the establishment.
Correct. And there were reports that maybe Lyndon Baines Johnson and even George H.W. Bush might have had a role in the assassination.
Well, it couldn't have been George Bush because he doesn't know where he was at the moment in time it happened.
Of course.
Yeah, I say that tongue in
Amnesia.
cheek because I know exactly where I was at when Ronald Reagan was shot, when I heard that he was shot. Those events, people know. I know exactly where I was at when 9/11 happened. He knows exactly where he was at, but he said that I just don't recall. So,
Very
how does all
briefly.
this tie into immigration, Susan?
Okay. So we have an agenda in tow that in which immigration is being incentivized and is being weaponized against the American people. So essentially the elites have us paying for our own demise. There was another group that has been very instrumental in advancing this agenda. It's called the International Rescue Committee. And you'll find that among the board of directors is Winston Lord, who is the protege of Henry Kissinger, Larry Fink, who is the head of BlackRock, Janet Napolitano, who was Obama's Secretary of Homeland Security and is now advising Biden on intelligence. This is a group that is facilitating the immigration of refugees into the United States.
I
And
might
that is.
also add for people that don't know, Janet Napolitano, before joining the Obama administration, was the governor of Arizona and has a clear view of how dangerous unfettered immigration is into a state or a nation.
And that's what makes her behavior even more astonishing, that you think that she would know better. She would know the impacts of the pol her policies.
So in 2010, Susan, a friend of mine, Rob Krenz, was murdered on his own ranch near Douglas, Arizona, by an illegal. And 30 days after that, I went to the very spot that he was murdered on his ranch with his widow, Sue Krenz. And at that time, when Janet Napolitano, former governor of Arizona, current Secretary of Homeland Security, made the statement that, well, we have to recognize that the first 30 miles along the border is no man's land. People have, this is part of the United States of America. It's part of Arizona. It's part of Texas. It's part of New Mexico. And to tell people who've been taking care of this land that is part of the United States of America that you're living in no man's land is unacceptable.
It is unacceptable. It shows a lack, a dereliction of duty, and also reflects a Caron worldview that, essentially Mexico and the United States are one and the same. Like there's a very fuzzy border between the two of them.
Exactly. So this is so my point to it's not surprising to me that she would be instrumental in this illegal immigration that is taking place today.
It is very distressing, and unfortunately, it's an agenda that is being driven from the top, and a lot of people are incentivized to go along with it. So you have, as we stated, the housing contracts. Valerie Jarrett has become a millionaire providing Section 8 housing for the poor, and which tend to be these newcomers. Sean Hannity, of Fox News, has also is involved in government housing. So many of these politically connected people have a financial vested interest in advancing the agenda. You also have contracts like the GEO Group, which are involved in contracts with processing the immigrants as they cross the border. So that's very lucrative. They run the military industrial complex. So the more crimes that are committed, the more money they make. The more the society is destabilized, the more contracts they get to stabilize society, to restore order, which in turn erodes our civil liberties and solidifies the power in the hands of the elite. But these individuals are thinking, you know, in terms of their own self-enrichment and are becoming fabulously wealthy by essentially betraying the country.
On the backs, betraying the country, and with the money of the country, who are out there trying to make a living and eke it out through their own families and their work.
And it's worse than that. And as I think you've spoken, I think we might have spoken on a previous show about how a number of these illegal immigrants are receiving money from the federal government. So if you have American families, you know, are increasingly have less disposable income, and these immigrants get free money courtesy of the taxpayers, they can then go out and spend that money. So the corporations continue to make profits. They now have, you know, manufactured inflation, so their profits are even greater. The illegals are able to purchase you know, these items at their higher rate, since the money has essentially been given to them, and they're given priority over jobs. I think, I don't know if you caught the Tysons.
Oh yeah. Let's talk about Tyson when we come back with more. Okay. Roll Route second half, Susan Bradford after this. I want to remind you about Healthy Living. Nitric oxide is how I start every single morning. NO2U.com. You can get all of the science behind what Nathan Bryan has dedicated his entire life to, healthy living through the most essential element, nitrate. Nitrate, look at, just, I'm not, don't take my word for it. Go look up what nitrate levels are in breast milk of a mother's at day one. That'll give you an indication how important this is for the infant and for the adult. NO2U.com, N-O, number two, letter U.com, nitric oxide on a daily basis. Dr. Nathan Bryant has the details. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Luce, alongside Susan Bradford, joining us, an investigative journalist. And now we're at something that has been in the headlines, particularly in my country, because of Tyson Foods. Tyson Foods announces in the past week that they're shutting down Perry, Iowa pork facility, which had 1,276 people working at it. But they also made an announcement that they were going to pursue 54,000 employees to be working that are illegals and work with them towards their asylum as they laid off the equal number of people who are American workers. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the large investment firms caught wind of this and said, hey, this is a violation of what we believe in. We're pulling our investment out of Tyson, which Tyson then responded right away, Susan, by saying, oh, we didn't make that statement. The media made it up. So now we have to make the decision. Is Tyson, have they been caught with their hand in the cookie jar? And they're trying to tell us that, no, that was all fabricated. We had to shut down Perry, Iowa. We're not laying off American workers. We're not seeking asylum workers to come in and replace them for, and probably get paid to employ them, quite frankly. Or did they literally get caught in the big lie? So what do you see developing with this?
That's interesting. I'm sure what happened was, like, maybe a combination of both. The media does try to stir the pot, you know, to pit the natives, you know, the American citizens against these new immigrants. Chaos is good for business and good for profits for those networks. But I think at the same time, a lot of these corporations are being incentivized to hire foreign workers over Americans. In fact, I remember seeing that the Biden administration was touting how America would become the new global leader in AI, but at the same token, they were recruiting foreign workers, H-1B-1 visa holders, to assume those jobs. Like, with all the Americans who are unemployed now, they wanted to bring in foreign workers to then, you know, assume those roles and be trained in AI.
On January 25th, 2023, BlackRock owns 7.2% of Tyson Foods. Now, why did I look that up? Because you just enlightened us to tell us that the International Rescue Committee which is working on illegal immigration into the United States, has a guy named Larry Fink involved. Do you see a parallel here? Is there a tie? Well, oh, clearly there's a tie. How deep is it?
He's on the board of directors of the IRC, and I'm sure that as an investor, he has a say in corporate policy.
We just found a new rabbit hole to crawl into, Susan.
We did.
They never end. We could never run out of rabbit holes.
But I think it should inform the public that there is a group of individuals that these rabbit holes all lead back to the same source, the same group of individuals pushing the agenda. And then most everyone else follows along.
Do you know what you have enlightened me more about than anything in our past 30 day plus days of communicating is that we know in today's world, and it's led by what's happening with the World Economic Forum, which I still think is mostly a distraction, but certainly what they say we need to pay attention to. But the one world order is not something that has just happened since 2000. You're giving me case in point that takes it back 100 years. We've had people angling and willing to invest 100 years to get us to this point. This didn't just happen since the formation of the Clinton Foundation.
It could really ultimately goes back maybe 2000 years, but it really gained momentum at the late 19th century in the city of London with a group called the Milner Group with Cecil Rhodes and the Rothschilds, where they were planning among themselves. Like they wanted to an elite to have a monopoly on wealth and power. And then they have systematically pursued strategies that would enable them to realize that objective. And of course, it's taken generations for them to get to that ultimate goal.
So this seems unrelated, but I think it's totally related. I looked up this morning GDP because I'm stuck with that speech that retired Colonel Douglas MacGregor gave as a response to the State of the Union last week. And he talked about the GDP of the United States, and 42% of that is from government spending. So obviously there's a rabbit hole. I went and dug into that, and 20 million Americans are working either as employees or contractors for the federal government. The GDP of the United States is significantly the largest in the world, even bigger than China. I was a little surprised by that. 25% of the GDP of the world comes from the United States. Now, take in consideration, 40% of that is from government spending, which I have a major problem with. China is second. But the most telling figure was China GDP per population is $17,000. And the United States per person is $75,000.
Wow.
Those numbers are stark, and certainly plays a role in everything that we're talking about here with this financial conglomerate in London that tries to control everything in the world.
Correct. And we were the wealthiest nation, and they used our resources in order to enrich themselves. They're leaving each American holding the debt. I think I read a report recently where the World Bank, which is one of the tools of globalism, it was established after World War II, through the Bretton Woods system, and they had it admitted to decoupling, moving towards decoupling the dollar from oil because it's no longer sustainable. So we're looking at how they have used the petrodollar to essentially finance their creation of the entire world. And they also, since the World Bank controls the price of oil, they're able to manipulate that price in order to weaponize finance and usury against the third world nation. So I don't know if you're familiar with debt diplomacy, but generally they would paint the World Bank would paint themselves as great philanthropists who wanted nothing more than to help the third world. They would loan money to poor countries, impoverished countries, have them put up very valuable assets as collateral, and then they would impose debt upon those nations and seize the assets. So the petrodollar and being able to control the price of oil was one of the strategies that they used to do that. So now they're actually acknowledging that they're having to move away from, this petrodollar.
I'm chuckling
just
because
one manipulation, one big scam.
Kelly and I bought this place that we have here in 2006 from a guy who used to own a bank. And when he owned the bank and he was an ag lender, he was buying. No, he wasn't buying. Let me start over. He was loaning money to a group of people in a geographical area that's 10 sections large, and the 10 sections, each section 640 acres. So we got one of those. And as a lender, he would loan the farmer the money and then impose penalties and fees to the point they couldn't afford it. And guess who acquired all of the land he had money loaned on?
It's got to be the bank.
He followed their blueprint. He was watching what was going on in the one world order, and he did the same thing.
Yeah, it's horrendous. I think we have to move towards eliminating usury and these very high interest rates. Were you familiar with the class action? I think it was in the 1980s, in which the banks illegally foreclosed on farms, on the farmers.
Oh, yes. That was led by Production Credit Association. I got my first loan from Production Credit Association in 1979. I was 10 years old, Susan.
Wow.
It was for $1,000, and I bought two pigs.
Good for you.
But I couldn't walk you through exactly. I just knew that it happened. I couldn't walk you through the implications. I just clearly remember the 80s and the farm crisis and what that all led to.
What did it lead to? My understanding is that it was supposed to lead to a full disclosure of the fraud within the banking industry, and then somehow something happened and the fraud was covered up.
It certainly did not lead to what the intent was. What it led to was, as you know, we had interest rates at one point in time in the banking system in the 80s at 18%. And nobody could make an 18% loan work. You saw bank foreclosures on farms and an exodus of farms that it was even beyond what happened in the 20s. So the 20s and the 80s were the 2 years of farm crisis.
Interesting.
And clearly that is when the structure of farming changed. And after the 80s, the biggest one changed, because I graduated high school in 1984. I chose not to go to college because I knew I was going to be a farmer the rest of my life. And at that time, this was what the most dangerous thing that happened. And we see that now looking back. Coming into the 90s, you had to either be a crop producer, or you were a pig farmer, or you were a cattle feeder, or you were in something. We no longer have, and I'm talking in mass numbers, we no longer have people that have a few cows to milk, that have some sows, that have some chickens. And everybody became so specialized after the 80s because the bank said, you are too diverse. We have to specialize you. And in order for you to get funding, you're going to have to seek a contract, and we're going to put protection in where the risk management comes from. And those contracts typically came from the end user. And guess who led the way in those contracts? A company called Tyson Foods.
Wow.
And they completely contracted the production of animals so that you probably did not own the chickens that you feed every day. You didn't own the pigs that you fed every day. You own the buildings that are in them. And Tyson Foods led the way in developing and changing this whole contract system where you were just, and it was an assurance. You were getting paid a certain amount each year. And as long as you met your contract obligations, you continued to get your payment. You made your payment at the bank, and it all worked well. But then the facilities wore out and you had a liability instead of an asset. And it literally changed American agriculture forever. Now, in a small way, you have this shift back to people diversifying on the farm and having multiple sources of income, selling raw milk or selling eggs off of the farm. You have people who are doing that in a small way. And then you have the Tyson Foods who stay in a very much of a large commercial economies of scale, trying to get a penny profit on a dollar spent. That's where we're at today. And it all happened because of what the banking industry did in the 80s. Susan Bradford will be back with the last segment. Roll route after this. Now let's take a moment to talk about Apache Sprayer. Simpson Farm Enterprises continues to get the job done. Innovation, reliability, service. It's all about managing the pest at your farm and location. Those pests include weeds and include insects. You know, those pesky little bugs and things that bother you day in and day out. And don't forget, maybe some fertilizer application. That all comes as a result of Apache Sprayers, the technology and the innovation. SimpsonFarm.com to get full details, particularly if you're from Nebraska South. If you're north of Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, go to HighPlainsApache.com. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Lewis, Susan Bradford. She's the one that said it earlier on that all the rabbit holes lead back to the same place. Here, we thought we were talking about the banking system, and then we end up talking about Tyson Foods again. And I do have to say this, Susan, that I never met Don Tyson, the guy who started the business. I'm pretty sure, like so many people who start a business and have the idea of growing, he's flipping over in his grave with what is happening with his publicly traded company now, because Don Tyson was just a good old boy wearing bibs, wanted to feed people. That's what he did. And when people like BlackRock, who make board decisions sitting in a cubicle in London, are involved in what's happening on a farm in Fayetteville, Arkansas, problems tend to arise.
Yes, I think, you know, we could see this at with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that you know, the Soviets, for all their faults, they had established very you know, they had solid businesses that engaged with the rest of the world. This new crop, these new oligarchs, have they went in and they looted all of those companies, and they left them to be a shadow of their former selves. I know that during the 1980s. That Reagan tried to, he gutted the antitrust laws. He tried to pave the way for the growth of monopolies in the interest of profits. And one area that he did this was with the pharmaceutical companies. So essentially he had the federal government subsidize universities to come up to develop patents for drugs. And then those patents were given to the pharmaceutical companies at no cost to develop on their own, where they could then establish and generate all the profits for themselves. And then in turn, they became these great monopolies that now are the leading sponsors of our media, in turn enabling them to kind of control the programming, or at least to ensure that specific things concerning the pharmaceutical companies are not discussed.
One other thing happened.
A lot of this happened during the 80s.
One other thing happened during the Reagan administration, as it involves pharmaceuticals, pharmaceutical companies, which plays a big role in today's world, is their liability for the products was
correct.
Removed.
Yeah, that's correct. Where they cannot be sued for the drugs that they make, however harmful they happen to be.
That's insane. How does that happen under what I thought was the best president in a century of American presidents?
That's a very good question. I think because the Cold War was ultimately a ruse, we were not fighting against the Soviets. Wall Street controlled both sides. The war was about unleashing the federal funds into these private contractors, and to enable them to establish intelligent networks around the world under the auspices or the pretext of fighting communism. So the war helped them help the elites expand their global empire. And at the very end, they had decided, okay, well, we'll end the Cold War. You know, miraculously, the Berlin Wall fell down, the Soviet Union collapsed overnight. And they began a new system. And the new strategy was pursued between Reagan and Gorbachev, based upon Lenin's new, I think his new economic policy, which involved kind of rebranding communism, kind of making it appear real nice and palatable to the American people and to the West, so that it could continue onward. So Reagan was very much on board with the shadow agenda, as we saw, through Iran-Contra and other matters. He was portrayed as a great defender of freedom and democracy, but I think he was also part of the plan, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is unfortunate, because that speech he gave in 1969, called A Time of Choosing, could not be more appropriate in any day since. I mean, it's just the perfect script on what needs to be done and said.
And you're exactly right. It's a script. I think we have to watch at what our leaders do, not only what they say, because they do, they want to tell us what we want to hear, so that we will put our support behind them, and then they expect that we will not pay attention to what they're actually doing.
Susan, we continue to identify hurdles. And I never want to be one that's identifying these problems and all, tracing all the money back to the oligarchs of the world, whatever an oligarch is, without providing people at the local level to say, hey, what do I do? What advice do you have, and what people need to do to combat all of this global influence of wealth?
That's a large question. I think, again, we have to look locally. A lot, I think there are small communities who are pushing back, and they're telling their stories to the media, to the public, you know, online through social media. And by bringing attention to the corruption, even on a small local level, by shining the spotlight on these people, on the practices, they are inclined to pull back, because they can only go so far with the consent of the American people. So I think that they can be challenged. We can petition our local leaders, even our national leaders, and they do have to respond to us. And I think the more that we can do so en masse, the more influence we will have as a group, you know, to kind of allow our voice to be heard.
In fact, that is happening as we speak in South Dakota. I don't know if you're abreast of this, but Senate Bill 201 passed through the House, passed through the Senate. It was signed by Kristi Noem, the governor. And Senate Bill 201 virtually eliminates all local control, particularly for pipelines in the local counties. Well, the citizens of South Dakota are not taking this lying down, and have formed an organization and have got the official language from the attorney general. And they are not right now. Monday, I'll be in Pierre at the state capitol as they are announcing the unveiling of a petition drive to garner 17,026 signatures in order that they can get Senate Bill 201 on the ballot this fall after the Senate and the House have passed this and perceivably made this a law. So to what you just said, it is unfolding as we speak in South Dakota, and I'm going to be there to help in full force.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm glad you are. And those are the types of strategies that do, in fact, work, as you're seeing. You know, they do have to respond to people.
I want to make sure that we bring a conclusion to where we started, and that is this immigration situation. What I wanted to do, almost in that vein, is that I wanted to start something, and have had communications with my own attorney general about this, but the illegal immigration that is happening into this country today is unconstitutional. It is, in fact, according to the definition of treason, treasonous. I want every elected official who's allowing this to happen in D.C. to be brought up on charges of treason, because it is at that level in my mind.
And I think that there could be another component to this, and that is that American citizens are born with their constitutional protections intact. And I think that the more Americans fight back, the more that our corrupt government is inclined to trying to weaken us. These illegals coming across the border, my understanding is that they do not have those same constitutional protections. And so that could be a greater reason why they want them here, is that they can be exploited, and they have little recourse, and they're essentially beholden and dependent upon those who are bringing them over.
I have personal experience communicating with sheriffs from around the nation, in my part of the world, in the Great Plains of America, that they have pulled over people who do not have any proper identification, cannot prove that they're citizens, in fact, are known to be illegals crossing the border. The county sheriff, the ultimate authority in every county, I know a couple of cases where they've called ICE, and I said, you have no authority over them, turn them loose. Well, they just broke a law in my county. It does not matter. You have no authority over them, turn them loose. This is a dangerous situation that we're walking into. Oh, and by the way, it was also verified that both of the individuals in this one particular car were openly members of MS-13, the gang, and it seems as though they are being strategically placed in certain areas around the country.
They are. You've also heard about the squatter crisis.
Absolutely. I saw one of a million-dollar home that the people were squatting in yesterday, I think in New York, maybe.
And they are organizing caravans of individuals to go and take ownership of abandoned homes or those in which the owner has not been present for, you know, for a certain amount of time. These drug cartels are trained back in their own country through, you know, these drug groups that were trained by our CIA, and they formed transnational criminal networks that ultimately are controlled by the International Crime Syndicate, which again leads back to the City of London and the Rothschilds. So this is like, these are their mercenary armies who are, you know, who are being weaponized against the American people. And I think if you can imagine the United States as a corporation, the government as a corporation, and then these are individuals that they are maybe contracting with or through to serve a specific purpose. And so the federal government is able to fund them since they are delivering upon that service, which unfortunately is not in our interest.
Which is the only explanation you need for why they're getting paid $2,200 a month just to come in. They're literally contract employees for the federal government.
That's exactly
at,
correct.
At my and your expense.
That's true, and they are being weaponized against us.
And my guest every Monday on this very program employs H-2A workers from Chile and Peru, and they're both calling both countries, people who work in both countries are calling home, and the home people are telling them that they're emptying the jails and giving people transportation to the southern border of the United States. It's not a rumor. I know people that know what's happening.
Correct. And they're creating more, you know, destabilizing the United States. And I read recently that a number of Democrats are actually begging the federal government to bring in these illegals because since a number of their districts are failing due to their failed policies, Americans are leaving in droves and going elsewhere to Florida and other states. And so as their demographics shrink, they're needing a new, like, refreshed population that can then justify the number of representatives who can then, you know, represent those districts in the federal government. So the more illegals you have, the more votes those few remaining citizens count within the federal level, and the more money those districts can then claim from the federal government. So
Susan,
there's also being
Susan, we have 1 minute. You okay. Have books that people need to get a hold of and follow you on Substack. You want to just walk us through that in 1 minute?
Sure. You can link to my Substack and my books through susanbradford.org.
Okay. And the one book, if they just picked one book to read, which one would it be?
I think Taking Back America would be a key one. That book outlines the step-by-step how the criminal elite have established their money laundering operation and have essentially subverted the country.
At the end of the day, who could not agree on the sentiment of taking back America? Susan Bradford, thank you so much. We will see you next week.
Thank you.
We have successfully journeyed down the path, connecting food producers to food consumers. For Susan, I'm Trent. Both of us reminding you that all roads do lead to a roll route. Don't forget to check out Greg Hager. His music and his country roots will keep this nation in boots. GregHager.com.